welcome to the Daily Reprieve, where we provide SA speaker meetings, workshops, and conferences in podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast. If you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by going to donate.thedailyreprieve.com and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Please consider donating monthly by clicking the Donate Monthly button. However, one-time donations are always welcome. Just click the Donate Now button. Now, without further ado, this episode of The Daily Reprieve.
I have to you, Nicholas.
Okay, great, Jason. Thank you very much. My name is Nicholas. I'm a lust addict. And by the grace of God and the program of Sex Works Anonymous, I've been sober from lust for 28 years. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. I'm going to talk about my rock bottom, but as I'm aware that one or two people on the call are pretty new, I just want to give you my simple take on this program. See, the reality is that I'm powerless over lust. I'm completely and utterly unable to cope with lust. That's why I need a higher power. But God keeps me sober. I don't keep me sober. God keeps me sober. And you know, that's the miracle, that God can and does keep me sober and has kept me sober for 28 years. But I have something I need to do. And while it's tiny in proportion to what God does, it's infinitely, for me, it's hugely, massively important. I had to join the fellowship. I had to get on board the SA Life Raft. I had to get a sponsor, that's somebody who can guide me through the 12 steps. And I had to work all 12 steps. And then I had to help other sexaholics to work the 12 steps. So that's it. God does one thing. He keeps me sober. I have to do four. Join the fellowship, get a sponsor, work all 12 steps, and do service by help, specifically by helping other sexaholics to work the steps. Now, some of you who are new in the program, that may be new to you altogether. Those of you who may have experienced relapsing, maybe there's something in there, some point that you've been missing that can help you in changing this pattern of relapse. So that being said, I'm going to talk about my rock bottom. And to do this, I'll just give you a little bit of my history. I wanted to be a soldier from the age of four. And I joined the army when I was 18. I became an army officer. And during my military career, I got married for the first time. And the marriage failed, and my career failed. Or at least I threw the baby out with the bathwater, and basically destroyed my first marriage and my first career. So, being a slow learner, I immediately jumped to the conclusion that I had got the wrong career and the wrong wife. So I then started my own business, and got married a second time. And to my amazement, exactly the same thing happened. Looking back on it, I realized that 12 years was exactly the period of time it took to go through a massive boom bust, just like I did in my first career. You know, I was a rising star in the military and then everything smashed down. And then with a business career, exactly the same thing. I was a rising star in business and then everything smashed to the ground. And I was just about to start on career three and marriage three. I'm a slow learner. When I was 12 stepped. And somebody came into town and they mentioned this word sexual addiction, which was a phrase I'd never heard before. But the effect on me was like being hit with a sledgehammer. It was literally like somebody had hit me with something, you know. And that was it. My kind of denial broke. There was something terribly going wrong in my life. And I now need to find out what it was. And it looked like it was something to do with sex. I just want to mention one other experience that I had before this. I was in my second career, which was coming apart at the seams after a great deal of success. It was really coming apart, threat in danger of bankruptcy. And my second marriage was coming apart as well. My wife was obviously very unhappy with me. I took her off to see a relate counselor to see if the relate counselor could sort her out, because obviously, you know, I thought she had a problem. And we had six sessions with the relate counselor. who then announced that she wasn't going to work with us anymore because she only did six sessions. That was all she was, that was her contract, as it were. I was a bit shocked by that because I could see that she hadn't yet fixed my wife. So, you know, it was obviously hadn't been a success as far as I was concerned. And on the way out of this last session with the counselor, she was a little woman. She came up to sort of about my shoulder. And as I was walking towards the door, she buttonholed me and she jabbed me in the chest with her finger. And she said, "And you," she said, "I don't know what your problem is, but if I were you, I'd spend some time and money finding out." Okay. 18 months later, with my second career and my second wife gone, I was being 12-stepped into a sex fellowship, from which I eventually came to realize that I was powerless over lust. I came to realize that I was also powerless over food, that I was powerless over alcohol, and that I was actually powerless over me. All of my defects of character, all of that was, you know, what eventually emerged, you know. And with that constellation of problems, it wasn't really surprising that I kept flying into walls. After great, you know, intensity and enthusiasm, my military career, and then for my business career, and I'm, you know, I'm really putting a lot into this, and suddenly it all collapses. It's like I've literally built my house on sand, and every time, you know, a flood comes or a little bit of rain, even, it just washes away. Down it comes, and there's nothing I can do about it. And it's the most horrifying thing when you see, it's like the slow motion train wreck they talk about. You know, to see, I can see that my everything that is important to me in my life, my marriage and my career, family, it's all gone. I'm going to lose the whole lot. It's all going to fall apart. And that sort of terrible sensation. And I think that's what I would think of as my rock bottom. Now, I didn't come in to the fellowship thinking I've got a problem with sex and I need to stop. I came in basically into the fellowship with a step one part B problem. My life was unmanageable by me. And I kept crashing into walls. I didn't know the exact underlying causes of that. And it sort of kind of like eventually turned out to be a history of childhood sexual trauma, which I hadn't actually faced, right? And which resulted in me feeling continually restless, irritable, discontent inside, and that therefore I was going to seek ways of medicating my feelings. And one of my first memory of medicating my feelings was sitting in my high chair. I'm about 2 years old. I'm looking at my mother. She's beaming at me. And I'm slurping down a big pot of sweet, runny porridge. And I'm getting this wadged up feeling inside. And suddenly life is golden. Here we are. I've got three of my addictions, you might say, all in one: drinking, food, sugar, and lust. And it's all there in that little picture. And that, you know, once I'd experienced that change in the way that I felt, and I would seek it. And so I would pursue that through, you know, food, through eventually through sex. Once I got to that sort of age, once I learned about masturbation, I got hooked immediately. And I was on a set of rails, really. There was no other way out of this situation. And I think if I had not found recovery, I'd be dead now, because that's where I was heading. You know, the stress involved in building up two high-powered careers and then crashing, in having two marriages and then smashing those as well. And it's like, I'm under a lot of stress. I need to find serenity. I need to find another way of living. So I guess that was it. My rock bottom was a rock bottom of life chaos. Destroyed two careers, two marriages, and lost a huge amount of money. I knew there's something wrong, like that counselor said. I don't know what your problem is, but if I were you, I'd spend some time and money finding out. But I did find out, you know, and I'm extremely glad, because once I knew what my problem was, then I could do something about it. You know, that had a hope of addressing the problem. Now, when I got down to writing my sexual inventory, because I was actually 12 stepped into another S fellowship, and one of the first suggestions I was given was to write a sexual inventory. I started writing, and it page after page after page after page, and so it began to dawn on me, my life has mainly been about sex. I thought it was about other things like careers and maybe even marriages, but actually it's all about sex. All the time, I'm either, you know, I'm doing it, or I'm enabling it, or I'm kind of like recovering from it. It's somehow it's like the weft of the warp of my life. It's like a continuous theme that's running through all of this. That I'm wanting something. I'm wanting to get something, and I think this is, to me, is the essential quality of lust. It's about getting. It has nothing to do with giving. I'm wanting a fix, and I'm wanting to use an image, a fantasy, or a live human being as a means of getting that fix. And that's one of the things that's terrible in retrospect, to realize that I was just using images, fantasies, and people to change the way that I felt. And of course, after, you know, I fairly soon came to realize that once I'd had my fix, I had as much use for the person I'd fixed on than an alcoholic has for an empty bottle. And so I would literally abandon. Well, that wasn't much fun. So what I got into was this sort of romantic fantasy and seduction process, which I would drag out for a long time until eventually I'd have sex with the person, and then I'd be out the door, was gone. Now, my two marriages were the exceptions to that. And the tragedy, looking back on it, you know, that was that there was lust in my marriages, which meant, as the White Book tells us, lust kills love. So if I'm lusting after my wife, it's killing my love for my wife, which is again interesting on reflection. Anyway, I mentioned to you that I was just about to start on Career 3 and Marriage 3 when I was 12-stepped, and so what I did was I stepped out of the opportunity for Career 3 and the opportunity for Marriage 3 and committed myself to the program. And I worked the program. I worked 12 steps. I worked the program in the other S fellowship until, you know, I decided that I've been sober now 4 years, no pornography, no masturbation, no sex outside a committed relationship, no relationship for the foreseeable future. I've been sober by these four self-imposed, self-designed bottom lines. I've been sober 4 years. It's about time I had a relationship in recovery. So that's when I, without adult supervision, without a sponsor at the time, I thought it would be a good idea if I had a relationship in recovery. So I looked around, selected a suitable victim, a woman who was in a 12-step recovery, who had a recovery that I admired, and I started on a sober courtship. Well, you know, boundaries began falling. You know, I might claim that I was technically sober, but I'd given myself a sort of a schedule that, you know, after this amount of time, you know, we'd be holding hands, after this amount of time we'd be kissing, after this amount of time there'd be some petting and so on. You know, I had literally kind of a schedule of how this sober relationship should develop. Well, it didn't work out too well, you know. Boundaries started falling, and I ended up, you know, having a sexual relationship. Obviously, I was saying myself that this was a committed relationship. And now, then, and this is going to make it, because another rock bottom is my partner, it turned out, bless her, she's now dead, but she turned out that she was I didn't kill her, just in case you were wondering, but she did die after we'd split up. But I found out she disclosed that she was, like me, a victim of childhood sexual abuse, specifically incest. And after she'd had sex, she would go bonkers and attack me. The next day, she would go, you know, go into rabid warrior and attack me. And I had to sort of defend myself physically. And I realized that if this went on, someone was going to get hurt. Someone was actually going to get killed. And I'm a trained killer, so that was, you know, it was a worrying situation. I remember calling a male rape crisis line to have a chat to them about this, you know, situation, what I should do about it. Anyway, I concluded that I was going to have to set a boundary with this damsel. I said to her, if you attack me again, I'm going to stop having sex with you. And if you attack me still a second time after that, I'm going to withdraw from our relationship. I'm going to go away. You know? So anyway, so she did attack me again. We had sex again. She did attack me again. So we then went into the no sex thing, the no sex boundary. But I couldn't keep my own no sex boundary. So here I am. I'm having sex with her again, and she's violent again. So now I realize I'm actually going to have to leave. I'm going to have to leave the relationship. And it was at this time that it really dawned on me that actually this wasn't sober. I wasn't sober. I was telling myself I was, because that had been, you know, the boundary that I had set was no sex outside a committed relationship. I was calling this a committed relationship. Therefore, it was okay. It began to dawn on me that I was going to have to change my sobriety definition to no sex outside marriage. Now, you might say no sex outside a committed relationship and no sex outside marriage are similar, but they are really different, fundamentally different, substantially, spiritually different. Believe you me, I can tell, because a big change happened when I made that commitment to change from no sex outside marriage to from no sex outside a committed relationship to no sex outside marriage. And I made that decision on the 12th of April, 1995, which is 28 years ago. And that is my sobriety date, because making that decision allowed me to withdraw from the relationship, to stay sober while withdrawing from the relationship, and to stay sober by the grace of God ever since. So for me, it was a really important moment. I've heard it said, human beings are created for the sake of choice. It's a very good saying that it's our choices, the way we exert our will, that is fundamentally important. I later on came to realize that, you know, that God had given me this will so that I could use it in favor of his will, as it were, that I could say, look, I could align my will with God's will. Up until that point, I was always aligning it with my own will or something else, or some chasing some other fantasy. But when I chose no sex outside marriage, I felt it in every cell of my body, because I was choosing God's will. I'm sure of that. Today, I'm absolutely convinced of that. Nobody could dissuade me that I was making a choice then to align my will with God's, that God wants me to be sober. He wants me to be sober and wants me to abstain from sex outside of marriage. Now, at this point, I was in another S fellowship, okay, when this was going on. 3 months down the road, I found out about a fellowship called SA, where there's everybody in it is committed to the same sobriety definition as me. So at that point, I walked right in. But I would say, you know, those are the my rock bottoms, being the boss of my own business, seeing it coming apart, the banks calling the overdraft, the liquidators at the door, my wife's wanting a divorce. I'm seeing my second career, my second marriage collapsing around me. I've got this terrible sensation in my stomach, like my guts are rotting. That was a rock bottom. I had no idea I had an addiction.
4 minutes.
And then, thank you. And then later on, realizing that, hey, I did have not just one, but several addictions, and that I was going to have to commit myself to a manner of living which was beyond my wildest dreams. If you could tell me 28 years ago, Nicholas, you're not going to have sex for the next 28 years, I would have fallen off the chair laughing. It's like, that's impossible, absolutely impossible, from a number of points of view. But that's how it's been. I'm very glad today that I am well and happy. I'm absolutely, totally committed to the mother of my children, who lives in another part of the country, and thinks that I'm the worst thing that's ever crawled out from under a rock. But she can't stop me loving her, so that's what I do. I enjoy that. And I'm really pleased to be here. I hope what I've said is of some use to you. I don't know how it relates, but maybe there's something in that for you. If I had more time, I'd tell you about an amazing miracle that happened only yesterday, which I'm sure is a direct result of recovery.
You do have enough. I'll leave it there. You have 4 minutes to go, Nicholas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Gave you a 4 minute warning.
Right. It was a 4 minute. I thought he said two. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, in that case, I'll tell you what happened. Yesterday, my son went to visit the new business, which he is joining in July. So he hasn't joined yet, but he went there for a sort of quaint day. And because I had helped him with the decision about whether to leave his existing work and to take this job, and so I was quite interested in going to see the business. So I actually was invited to go. Now, as soon as I was invited to go along, my fear came up. Well, you know, I'm going to be like, you know, I'm like the Ancient Mariner at the wedding. I mean, you know, what am I going to do? What are people going to think of me? I'm old. I'm, you know, over the hill and all that sort of stuff. So all kinds of negativity came in, and of course, as soon as that happened, I knew that I was being asked to step 10 it. You know, to surrender my fears and my cowardice and my self-centeredness and my worry about what other people think about me and my toxic shame and everything, and you know, and ask for courage and trust in God and so on, and just go. And so I went, even though I was inside, I was saying, oh, I don't want to do this. I walked through that fear, had a most interesting day. So first of all, watching my son and seeing him interacting with everybody there. And then, to my utter amazement, being asked completely out of the blue by his new boss, his future boss, if I would provide him with some personal mentoring. So I've gone to have a look-see at this business, and I've ended up being invited to mentor the boss that my son's going to be working for. Now, how does that happen? I mean, you know, I've been retired for 14 years now since I was in business. I'm well over the hill. I wasn't expecting it. It was completely come out of the blue. So I knew it had to be God. It had to be God. And so that's it. We mustn't leave before the miracle happens, and just keep working the program, and amazing things will happen. You know, things continue to unfold. And I'm extremely grateful. The journey continues, you know. God's not finished with me yet. So thank you once again for letting me share. Please keep me in your prayers. I'll keep me in yours. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Daily Reprieve, the best source for experience, strength, and hope for SA members. Please subscribe to this podcast to be alerted of new episodes. Please show your support by donating to The Daily Reprieve by going to donate.thedailyreprieve.com and choosing either monthly donations or a one-time donation by clicking Donate Now. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Daily Reprieve.